I'd like to tell you about my first two student trips. First one, I went out here on the Rocket. They still ran the Rocket when I went to work. And John Northern was a fireman. I knew John. I'd known him ever since I was old. So I went to Boonville with him. He and Wesley Wood. And so I came back, and I was came back on 994 with Glenn Enfield and a fireman named McDaniels. I don't remember. You remember
him?
Yeah. Anyhow, here we are sailing down the railroad, you know, second time I'd ever been on a locomotive. And the fireman went back to check, and we had two or three diesels, I don't know what. They came back in a minute, and he told Enfield he needed to come back there. There was something back there the engineer needed to look at. And they both went back there and left me up there by myself. Scared me to death. Of course, it's time, you know, it was something different. And the second time, I went out here on, we used to have a local, went out here on Jones Mill, went to Jones Mill, came back, called Jones Mill, turned it steam engine. And the first time I was ever on steam engine, and I forget who the fireman was, but as soon as we left here, he put me in the fireman's seat, showed me the firing valve and how to handle the water and this and that and the other. And I think old Bill, can't think of his last name, one of them old heads with a hog head. And we were sailing off down the branch down here, and everything's going pretty good. We got down to Vimy Ridge, which is about 10, 12 miles south here, and we hit two torpedoes. That scared me. That really scared me. And the old hoghead, he just reached up and slammed the throttle off, and I didn't shut the firing valve off, and oil just flooded, you know, and black smoke came out, and I thought we was all dead right there. It scared me to death. But I adjusted to it finally. Riding a steam engine. You've ridden steam engines, I guess.
Never did.
You ride a steam engine 50 to 60 miles an hour, it's an experience. It's a lot different than riding a diesel engine.
Banging around?
Yeah, it tends to rock more than a diesel locomotive will. But I fired for about a year, I think, before the steam was gone. Howard, he was there 4 or 5 years before I was. He grew up with the diesels more or less. Well, I did too, really.
This is Howard Smith. One of the trips that I can remember very, very clearly, we was going west on a steam engine, and was out at the Murray Locking Dam going around the bluff, and at this particular time the steam engines were being phased out of the railroad and diesels were coming in, and they were not putting any more money into the steam engines than they absolutely had to. Consequently, they were very bad repair. We were out there about locking dam, and one of the flues blew out of this steam engine, and that put raw steam into the firebox and on out the door. And I climbed out the fireman's side, and over the window there's a big rail which you could hang on to, and I was holding on to that. The engineer got up in front of his seat as far as he could, and naturally, the steam just went down to zero rapidly. And when that happened, the air brake, air compressor stopped, and the brakes set up on the train, and we were out there dead. Like you might say, dead in the water. As
close
the Navy,
to the water,
Navy
yeah.
would say, they were dead in the water. But anyway, we didn't have radios then, and there was no way to tell anybody what the problem was. We couldn't tell a conductor. And so the engineer, he had gotten a little bit of burn from the steam, but not enough to be too serious. And so I told him to go on back to the back, and I put the train and the brakes, all the brakes in position to be towed back in, and then I had the duty of carrying his grip and my grip on this ballast, which was about the size of your fist about there, for about a half a mile back to the caboose of that train in the dark without a light. That was quite an experience on a steam engine. Anyway, we got back to the caboose and told them what was wrong, and they got a hold of the dispatcher, and then they sent, I believe the road phone of engines came out there in his car and took us back into Biddle to the to the shops. And my experience on steam engines was just one, every trip was a just almost a complete failure. I mean, something would happen very badly on every trip, you know. And what Harold was talking about the engines vibrating. When we had steam engines on our passenger trains, they'd run them, they had no speedometers on the steam engines, on the ones that we had. Now, the later ones had steam speedometers, but the ones we had didn't have any steam speedometers. And we would run around 75 or 80 miles an hour, and we'd determine our speed by looking at the milepost markers on along the road, and we'd check and see how we was going. And we were running, a lot of times we'd run 75 and 80 miles an hour. Now on a steam engine, if you're running that fast on these older steam engines, it was vibrating and shaking so badly you couldn't walk without holding on to something. You had to hold on to something or you'd be down. And then you was trying to keep the thing hot, enough steam going, and water, where you won't run out of water on the water glass. And I spent most of my time on the steam engine staring at the water glass and the steam gauge.
That's right, I did too.
I went over the whole railroad for years there, and I never knew what was going on the outside, because you had to watch it. And different engineers had different techniques of how to adjust the throttle and the reverse lever to where they would get the most efficiency out of the steam and use the least amount of water. And that was one of the big issues on a steam engine, is never run out of water, because when you run out of water, that was it. You're dead in the water again.
You blow up.
You're dead in the water. And some of the engineers could go past water stops to the next one without any problems, and others, they'd have to stop at every water stop to get water. And that was a big
Yeah, an engineer can make it harder on a fireman, even on an oil burner. We had oil burners. They went in oil back in the, Rock Island went in oil back in the 20s when they discovered oil down in El Dorado and out in Oklahoma. But an engineer could wear a fireman out even with an oil burner.
Yeah. I went to Pratt, Kansas one year during the wheat rush, and I got to fire one of the newest steam engines that the Rock Island ever had. It was a 5100, and they were all roller bearings. All the journals and the drivers were all on roller bearings, and they had water pumps. You didn't have regular injectors like we had on the other steam engines. And they were just like getting out of a T-model Ford into a Cadillac. It would be a good comparison to get on one of those new 5100 engines. They were just, shut the throttle off and they would glide along there just as smooth as you could imagine. And no problem on keeping the water. You could adjust the water with your water pump with the valve there. It was really, really something to be able to get on one of those. But I didn't get to fire those, but about two or three months out there, they called me back to those other ones. That's all I want to tell you right now. I'll let the Buddy have over here.
I'm Buddy Bryan. I'm the youngest one of these two. When I quit working for the railroad, I had 45 years. I worked the Missouri Pacific, about
9 years.
Yeah, why about nine. Well, Rock Island for 30 years, then Missouri Pacific about 10, then the Union Pacific swallowed them up. And when Harold retired, that left me to being the only or the last Rock Island engineer out there on the system, and I wasn't very well liked either. I went to work for the railroad to Rock Island in 1952. I was going to UALR with a deferment, and my dad said, "Oh, you're wasting your time, throwing your money away. Quit that thing out there." I was going to school to be a dentist. So I did. I quit, and they promised me that I'd get drafted when I quit, and sure enough, about two or three months later, I got a request to go in the Army, and luckily I went to Germany during the Korean War and spent all my time in Germany. And when I came back, they didn't have any steam engines left. I was told, I think they might have had one. And the road foreman told me, he said, if they call you for that steam engine, he said, don't accept the call because we're getting rid of it and you don't have to fool with that. So I think my first job was maybe a hostler, or a hostler helping job in Memphis, and that went on for a while. And then I came back to Little Rock, or Biddle, and worked out of there. But I never did work on a steam engine, so I don't know anything about one at all. I always worked on diesel. And at that time, we had a whole lot of old Alcos, which was really a pile of junk. And then later we got some EMDs, and just before they shut down, we had some real good equipment. And I don't know how in the world they acquired that, because they were in such bad shape financially. But when Harold quit, he and I both were working for Union Pacific, and I believe he was working a day job and I was working an afternoon job. And when he quit, well, then I got his job and worked it for, I don't know, what, 3 or 4 years, something like that. And I don't know of any other thing that I need to tell you, that mostly we were going west one day, and going up through, I think it was Havana, and I saw this car, Ford, sitting up there, Ranchero, whatever it was, sitting right in the middle of the track. And we were probably doing 50 miles an hour and had probably 100 cars behind us and four engines. And I saw this old lady running up the track. Boy, she was swinging her purse like crazy. And, of course, I put the train in emergency, didn't have time to stop, so I hit him doing probably 45 miles an hour. This old man sitting in the front seat and had an old dog in there with him. Of course, I hit that, and the drawbar went right in the door. And I must have carried it probably a quarter of a mile down the track. Of course, it knocked him out instantly. He killed the dog. But if she had just used her head, she could have gotten him out of the truck, but she didn't do that. She thought maybe I could quit or stop the train, it was an impossibility. There was no way I could do that. I don't know of anything else really exciting that happened.
You know, I had that kind of experience when I come out of Memphis on 991 with Early, was the engineer.
Oh, boy.
Curtis Early. Anyhow. But it was dark. You know, we come out of there after dark, and we were over around Widener or somewhere. And I looked down the track, and I could see a light, just barely couldn't see a light, and it was kind of doing like that. And it's hard to figure out at night what's going on. And finally, it dawned on me, it was somebody with a light. They weren't giving a stop signal. They didn't know what to do, but they were waving that lantern. And I told Early, I said, put the train in emergency now. And he put the train in emergency, and we got down there. Oh, we got was probably within 200 or 300 feet of a flatbed and started across the track and got hung up like that. And that's I've always thought about that. We for a while, when they were building Interstate 40 between here and Memphis, they had a crossing down this side of Forest City where you go part of the way on the interstate and then you had to go back the old highway, you know, and you had to go across the crossing. And we had a crew, one of Buddy's cousins, yeah, as a matter of fact, and Beeson was the engineer, fell off that hill. It's right at the bottom of the hill leaving Forest City one day, and there's a big tank truck sitting. And I think I might have died. I mean, that was one of the big fears on the railroad. But it happened to be full of glue. They hit it. But it was fortunate. We had a train master over at Memphis named Dick Haley. And you come out of Memphis, down through West Memphis, they had a big tank farm there that hauled gasoline. And I told him, I said, when I go off that hill down toward that tank farm into West Memphis, I'm going to slow down. Yeah. I'm going to get slow enough where I can jump off one of them pulled out in front of me. And they never give you any argument about it, because it's happened, and the engine crew don't have a chance.
Well, that's one thing about Morgan Fowler. He'd get mad at me. I was firing for him at the time, and I would. I'd try to slow down a little bit, you know. You could at least jump up.
Yeah.
But Morgan get upset. What are you slowing down for? Those trucks up there in front of us, Morgan.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's talking about a passenger train a while ago. Rock Island used to have one of the, if not the fastest, short line passenger run in the world. Between Memphis and Little Rock. And he's talking about running 75, 80. They run 90, you know. And they had a Pullman that came out of the IC out of Chicago every day, and it came to Memphis, and they put it on this train going to Hot Springs. And 45 would come in here, and then I don't know where they'd same train to go on to Hot Springs. I don't remember whether they changed locomotives or they'd have another train. But it'd go on to Hot Springs to take that Pullman. And they used to have a lot of Al Capone, people like that, came over to Hot Springs to gamble, you know, and take the baths and everything. But steam engines were interesting. They really were.
You used to work with an engineer, Charlie who?
Charlie Coffin?
I fired for him, but...
Charlie Henson. Thank you, Henson.
Yeah. He said, now, buddy, get over here and run this train. And I said, but I'll tell you one thing. He said, you run it the way I want you to run it, or you won't run it. He said, now, when you get to be the engineer, you can do what you want to do, see? A lot of them had that opinion or felt that way, you know. Like I was coming out of Memphis, running from Morgan, or Dick Easterly. He said, Dick Easterly there, I've been on vacation and I was firing for, I don't know, whoever. And when I came back, he was a very undesirable engineer to work for. Nobody wanted to work for him or with him. But I got swapped off, and there I was working with him. And he said, I want you to forget everything these other engineers have taught you, and we're going to start all over again. See?
Who was this?
Dick Easterly.
Dick Easterly.
No, not Easterly. Dick Eller.
Dick Eller. Yeah, okay.
Well, Easterly wasn't a whole lot better. I came out of Memphis one night with him on passenger trains, and it was real cold. And he said, babe, I'm going to open this valve down here. It's the cab heaters they had up there. Well, all in the world he was doing was draining the water out of the engine. And we run out of water. Hadn't even hardly got out of Memphis if the thing was out of water. And I knew what he had done, but I couldn't say anything about it. And they came over there with the freight diesel or engine and put it on the front of the passenger train. We came in a little off with that. But you couldn't be critical of the way they operated. I mean, they was the boss.
Well, they had been around. You know, yeah. Most of the old engineers had, they've gone to work before the Depression, a lot of them. And they come back after the Depression, and they were a different breed than the ones that came along after us, as a matter of fact. When we had younger men come in, and they were all basically really good engineers. Turned out to be real good. Well, I say, but guys a little older than us, Howard, Buddy Flippin, Morgan Fowler, Armstrong, they were good engineers.
Sure they were.
But these old men, they left a lot to be desired, and you couldn't say anything to them. I like Floyd Boggs, hard-headed old rascal. I mean, his head is harder than that. And first job I caught with him, we got out to Maul Mill, I guess, first water hole, and I was out of water, you know. And it was just the way he was running the engine. It was partly my fault, you know.
Yeah.
And we finally made it to Boonville, and he wouldn't even get up and help, you know. And coming back, we got to Perry, and I had to take on water again. And I told him, I said, now, mister, I said, I don't know you. I said, but somebody told me there's a hill right out of here. I said, you're going to have to help me if we're going to get over that hill. We ain't going to have no damn water. But I'll tell you how hard-headed it was. Years later, it was 1958, I can remember, because it was Frank Brawl's first year as head coach at Arkansas. He came out of Boonville. He and J.D. Parker was his fireman. And they had a section man or something that worked on the track riding as a passenger. I think he'd come out of Howe and was going to Ola. And it was not uncommon, you know. The guys wanted to get home. Well, after they left Boonville, Floyd found out he's back there. And he told J.D., he said, I'm going to stop down here and you're going to put him off. And J.D. said, no, I'm not going to put him off. He said, if you want him off, you go put him off. So he stopped. It was dark. Couldn't see where he was. I mean, you know. I was going to go back there and put him off and got down on a footboard and slipped and fell. And he was on a bridge and killed him. Yeah, just think, you know, hard-headed old men. Unfortunately, I knew some of them. My dad ran a service station over on the east side close to Rock Island Railroad to the yards, and I knew a lot of them as a kid.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of them I didn't know. I was young. We were all young when we went to work, and it was a long time before I called some of them by their first name. I said, it was a Mr. So-and-so.
Yeah, and then they didn't like that because they thought you were making fun of them, a Mr. This and Mr. That, you know, and then...
Well, that's kind of the way we were brought up.
That's the way I was brought up.
Well, they're talking about these older men. Now, we had another group of men in there that came in during the war that were 4F. They couldn't qualify to be a soldier. And they were
like
fresh.
They were
fresh out of the cornfield. What they were, we had about six or seven of them like that, and most of them were alcoholics, and that was a very, very strict rule that the railroad tried to enforce was the use of alcohol, and these guys, they would do everything that they could to get around the officials on this alcohol business. But most of them had not even, I'd say 90% of them had never even finished high school at all. Most of them maybe fourth or fifth, sixth grades, about all they had. And that group, I'd imagine there was about seven or eight in that group.
Well, who was the one in Malvern? He was a good engineer, but they never did vote him, though.
Cockrell.
Jess Cockrell. He knew Malvern, and we had a lot of jobs at work at Malvern, and he was real good down there, but they wouldn't promote him.
I guess with them, they didn't make them take examination to be promoted to engineer. Later on, you had to.
Yeah.
But these guys, like he's talking about Turner, Spann, Cockrell, they never were promoted. They never were engineers. Old man McDaniels, of course.
He was a hostler in Memphis.
Yeah.
So they either fired or were a hostler for their entire career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we had to put up with they had to put up with us after that was all over.
Oh, yeah.
I guess they gave him the option back then. You know, Jimmy Harriet was a fireman. He was an old man. He was an old man when I went to work out there.
They had an option back there when we went to work. When you came up your time for promotion, if you didn't want to be promoted, you could stay on and hold your seniority as a fireman. Hmm. And Mr. Harrod, he was talking about, he was the local chairman for the firemen years and years. And they could hold the choice firing jobs on the switch engines, see. Hmm. And that kept these younger men from moving up to a better job. They'd be home on a midnight job, and he should be up here on the engineer's extra board, but he wouldn't take promotion. The same rule applied to the trainmen. The brakemen would turn down promotion for a conductor, and they'd ride their seniority as a brakeman, the very best trains that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And people under them that took promotion, they would be out here on the extra board or forced to sign to an out-of-town local or something like that. It was not really a fair situation, but that's the way it was. And most of our rules like that were negotiated in our wage contracts with the company. Uh-huh. And they've still got a bunch of them out there, but they've changed the rules now, and I don't know what all of them are, but they have done away with just about every one of those benefits that they used to have.
Well, look at Crenshaw. Stayed in Memphis on a hostling job until it come time to having to be promoted, and he didn't know what he was doing.
He got promoted, though.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story about Crenshaw, Frank Crenshaw. He was over Memphis for years as a hostler. And he got promoted, and he ended up over here on the engineer's extra board. And he called me one day. Well, I guess my regular job was Stuttgart local, and they called him as the engineer. My engineer laid off. So we left here on one of them old Alco switch engines, the old long ones on the front.
Yeah.
And you had to be real careful when they run hot real easy. And we left here, and we got over to, it was kind of cool, and he had hung his jacket over the temperature valve where I couldn't see it.
Yeah.
So we got over at Lone Oak and stopped for something, and I went over and I looked, and the temperature on that thing was 210 degrees. I said, man, you got to do something about this right now. I said, you get in this siding and go call the dispatcher and tell him that the engine's running hot, and we're going to have another locomotive brought over here. No, we're not going to do that. I said, yes, we are too. He said, no, we're not. I said, we're going to Stuttgart. So we're going to Stuttgart. I said, okay. And he took that thing to Stuttgart, and it was basically boiling all the way to Stuttgart. And we got over there and got off there. What you did, you left your engine and got another engine and came back. They swapped engine. They had a switcher worked over it. Well, he started to get off the engine. He started to kill the engine. I said, don't kill this engine. He said, yeah. I said, you're supposed to kill this engine. I said, don't do that. And he did anyhow. And they said the next morning, that crew came to work. And, of course, it didn't have any water in it. So they hooked it up with water, and they said water come out of every place water could come out of. Said it looked like Niagara Falls. And I ran into the road foreman, Raymond Rich. He said, what happened? I said, I'm the fireman. I didn't want to get in the position to say it was all Crenshaw's fault. I said, Mr. Rich, I'm just a fireman. He said, okay, I understand. That's the way it went. But we worked with guys like there wasn't a lot of them, but it bothered you to work with someone like that.
He was one of the worst ones.
I'll tell you a story, and I wasn't involved. In fact, it happened probably about the time Howard went to work, maybe, they had we had a passenger train, 111 night train, went out of Memphis and went to the West Coast, actually. But they left Little Rock one night, and an old man named Martin was the engineer, and he had a fireman, McDaniels, a young McDaniels, and he was new. And they had train orders to meet a eastbound freight train out here at
Pulaski.
It had siding out here, it was actually in the city limits. I take that back. I didn't have a meet with him. I had a wait at a certain time, such and such time. Well, I got out there, and the old man, Martin, was going to run the wait, and McDaniels kept telling him, and he told him just to sit over and shut his mouth and sit down, and they went right around that curve, his curve out of Pulaski, and run up in the head on in that freight train. The old man Martin got killed, and the engineer, Grady Herr, was on the freight train. He saw what was going to happen, and these steam engines had a big old asbestos curtain between the cab and the firebox, in the tender, and he just wrapped himself up in that. The fireman, he jumped off about the time they hit, and they cut his leg off. And McDaniels, I know he didn't. I guess he just jumped off.
He was on the passenger train.
Yeah, he's on the passenger train.
Well, the siding was Pulaski, and the next siding was Pinnacle. They might have been confused there. Pinnacle and Pulaski, see.
But you had like I said, McDaniels then was a fairly young man and new at firing. And we were all the same way when you went to dealing with old head engineers. You didn't hesitate to say anything to them.
Reference to age and experience.
Yeah, they're supposed to know what they're doing.
That's part of what goes on a railroad that you never read about in the paper or anything. And I've told a lot of people, they see an engineer sitting up there blowing the whistle, they think that that's the softest job in the world. But you put yourself in that engineer seat, and you'll have 100 cars that you'll just have a near misses with, and then you'll have the next one will be a dead hit. And I'll tell you a little story about one of mine. I was going to I had 20 or 30 cars of gravel, company gravel. Well, those company cars, without any criticizing the company at all, but they didn't have as good a brakes as other cars would have on them. And with a load of rock, that was the heaviest load they could get. I would guess right now that 9/10 of them were overloaded to start with. To make a long story short, when you had a train like that, you'd have to have about twice as much distance to try to get stopped. Well, I was going down towards Fordyce with this 20 or 30 cars of gravel, I don't know what it was, and this new Chevrolet Super Sport pulled up on the track down there in front of me. And I was blowing the whistle, and nothing happened. Directly the doors opened and everybody unloaded out of there, see? Well, we hit that new Chevrolet and just about cut it half in two. Well, we got back up there and this woman was sitting over there and she was just crying and carrying on something awful. And come to find out, she had borrowed that new car from some of her friends, and she was in there with a married man, and they had two or three six packs of beer in there. Make a long story short, we tore up a playhouse right there.
I had that same thing happen. What after they put, 14, 15, when they put that hot shot freight train on,
Yeah.
I think it was. Anyhow, I kind of bit them and got around here to the west side of town, down there by Cage's Wharf, and I hit a woman, and it just took the front end off, took the bumper, basically. It dented up the front end and everything. And I wasn't going fast. You could, at the time, it wasn't a 10-mile-an-hour speed between here and for the next first 40 miles. But I stopped and went back there, and we were all standing around there, and she said, oh, my husband's going to kill me. And I said, well, it's not, the damage is not that terrible. I don't think he's going to be that upset about it. She said, I ain't worried about the car. I said, he's in Jonesboro, and I've been over to this nightclub over here. She tried to explain what she was doing out. For a while, talking about that, the Rock Island got in such Let's go back. Well, you probably heard this before. But back in the, what, the 50s, the Union Pacific decided that they would like to buy portions of Rock Island and so forth and so on. Well, by the time we got around, you know, they got around to finally turn that down, the Rock Island was collapsing, basically. We ran from here to Perry, Arkansas, which is about 40, 45 miles, 10 miles an hour.
You could never, you'd hog law every trip.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You just didn't get from one place to another. Oh, I got mad one night. It was hard, you know, and a lot of men were sick. You know, they really had stomach aches and one thing and another, because you knew if the railroad didn't collapse, you'd get killed, you're fixing to lose your job.
Yeah.
In fact, I ended up in the hospital, seriously. But anyhow, we went out of here on a local one night, went all the way to Boonville, and we were over at Waveland waiting on an eastbound train, and we all went to sleep. We'd been up all night. And I was working with Conrad. Conrad run the engine. I happened to wake up, and here come the road foreman down the track. I told him, I said, wake up, here comes Thompson. He and I didn't like each other. And he come up there, and he went back there, and I think that maybe the brakeman was asleep on second unit. I don't know. He come up there and made some remark about what we were doing. We stopped back this end of the track, end of the siding, so we'd get a run at the hill when the train headed in. He didn't understand. He's too damn stupid for that. But anyhow, we got to Boonville, and guess who was standing there? Mr. Ivy, Carl Ivy, who worked here, but he was a train master. And I told him, I said, now, we get to Boonville, there's going to be a company officer, and he's going to say something about this. And so everybody just keep their mouth shut and go ahead on and don't say a word. Well, I got off, and Ivy walked up to me, and he said, what was going on down there, Mr. Rhodes? And when he did, I lost it. I said, let me tell you one thing. I said, we've been busting our butts up and down this railroad for 14 hours then, day in and day out, you know, trying to get from one end of the railroad to the other without somebody having to come out and tow us in all night long, no place to eat. And by God, I'm not going to stand around and be criticized for something like this. He said, oh, I had to calm down. He got me calmed down. And then the very next day, Sparky was a conductor. They called us out to go to, we went to Danville, and then we in a cab, and then we went over, got the engine, went over to the paper mill, and came back to Danville. We got back in plenty of time, and the road foreman, Thompson, met us and told us what a good job we did. Mm. Well, you know, we had some good officers. I was a local chairman, Howard was a local chairman, and most of the officers were pretty good men. Our superintendents, you know, we had Harold McDaniels and Homer Dyer, and Dick Haley was all right, and two or three others were nice. They were nice. We had some. Bill Honig, I wouldn't spit on him if he was on fire. Well, that's just what I
think. He was not too good. There it was, deadheading one night, and somebody said, well, where's the rest of the crew? He says, you mean excess crew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he always had some smart remark.
Honig.
Let me tell you a little story about, I think it was Harold. Didn't you head in at Mesa one day with a train up the Des Arc branch?
I did that several times.
Well, and then you started to get back out and you derailed.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me give you the story. Did you know the story on that?
I don't remember.
The next day after he derailed, and he had about 30 cars up this branch and two or three engines up there on that end, and the next day they sent me down there with the wrecking crew to re-rail those cars and pull that train back and bring all the rest of it in the middle. And Mr. Haley was the superintendent here at that time. Well, we got down there to Mesa, and the main line switch, the brakeman couldn't throw the switch. The fireman had to get off and help him throw that main line switch where we could get in there to get on his train. And Mr. Haley, he kept wanting to know what happened, what caused everything to happen so much. Well, anyway, we got everything cleared up and went on. And 6 months later, just happens one day, one of the men that was on that crew told me what happened. They had come down this branch on this local at a low speed, and they all went to sleep. They got down here to this main line, and they come right out on the main line, and the block signal was red. There was a train coming, one of our fast freight trains or the passenger, I don't know which one. But the block was red, and that red light caused this man to wake up. Well, they realized what the situation was when he woke up, so they got back up off there, and they couldn't get the switch to line up with the main line, and they went up to the tool house, broke the lock off the tool house, got some bars and things, and come down there and line that main line switch, and worked on it till they could get it to froze, see? And the train went on by, and everything was all right. But Haley kept coming up there on the engine, and I was down there to pick all this stuff up. He says, I have no idea what happened down here. We've looked and looked, and we can't find out what caused the derailment. You know? And I didn't know at that time. But six months later, I found out what had happened.
Yeah.
And you would be surprised. Now, when I went to work, you could work 16 hours. What these conductors would do, they'd tie up 15 hours and 59 minutes, and you'd get 16 hours pay. Well, a lot of them would put on their pajamas and go to bed back here on the caboose, and they'll tell you about 90% of the time at nighttime, the only one on that train awake was the engineer. 90% of the time. People don't know how many times, and every one of them, both of them will tell you that they went to sleep running that engine too.
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story. We left here 1-2 o'clock in the morning going west 991, and Robert Davis, it was just he and I, we didn't have a fireman. Robert Davis is brakeman. Robert never batted, believe he ever shut his eye. He was one of the best men you'd ever want to work with. We went our 10 miles an hour from here to Perry, and finally we got up where we run 40 miles an hour down through Perry. Well, down in front of the depot, Perry had 10 miles an hour slower. So I broke, set the brake. First thing I knew, woke up. I woke up and we'd stopped. He said, what's wrong? I said, what's wrong? He said, you got the brake set. He never, I said, okay. So I released the brakes, and we got over around Danville or Ola somewhere and had another 10 mile an hour slower, and it did the same thing, went to sleep. Mm. Woke up the train, and Robert said, you got the brakes set. I said, no. And I don't remember who the conductor was, but God bless him, he never said a word on the radio.
Well, I know he was asleep.
Yeah.
We got to Boonville, whoever it was, he got off, he said, what in the hell is going up there? I said, I was going to sleep. That's all there was to it.
You all probably remember this, but that there was a train going west at Waitland. They headed in at Waitland. This one coming from the west, going east. And these two brakemen were just talking with each other on the radio, and he said, "Well, I'm all in." Well, the engineer coming to meet him, he thought that they meant the train was all in. It wasn't. So how many cars and inches did they derail down there in that incident? Quite a few of them.
Carl Ivey was involved in that. He jumped off him, blew the brake belt, one of the brake belts, and I forget who. I got that investigation. Was you in that investigation?
Luther.
Well, it was a sad situation.
Yeah, I was in it. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. And we had a big investigation.
Well, they needed a big investigation. These two brakemen talking to each other, and that engineer thought, well, he's all in, but he wasn't all in.
Well, I'll tell you, two weeks before that happened, the same situation 2 weeks earlier, and I was on the train that had the right-of-way, and we come around the curve down there at Waveland, and they were just heading in up there, that local was, on our time. On our time, they were heading in. And we had old Joe Finley was the engineer. And we had 100 cars and about 3 big engines. And he was old. At that time, he was about nearly 70 years old.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
But anyway, Bill Herndon was the head brakeman, and we saw what the situation was, and we told the engineer to put it in emergency. Well, he did, but the train's coming downhill like this with 100 cars pushing you. So Bill and I couldn't stand it any longer. We went out on the footboard to jump off. And I was on the bottom step, and Bill kept telling me, said, wait, let it slow down just a little bit more before we jump, just a little bit more. And we're still doing about 30 miles an hour. And that train went right up there within a couple of car lengths of that train heading in, and it stopped. And we said then, said, somebody's going to get hurt right here. And 2 weeks later, the same identical thing happened, but they didn't get stopped. They hit the train.
Yeah, Ivy, I heard Ivy trying to get Luther to jump. He wouldn't do it, and Ivy jumped between his legs. I'll tell you something happened up there one time. They had a local going west. O. Beeson was the engineer. And they had the weed sprayer up there that day. And the track gets slick, as you know. And so they were going to meet the eastbound 994, whatever they called it at the time, at Ola. Well, they decided to run through the siding at Ola with a light engine and go down there and sand the rail. And then I think they were going to put a flag. I don't know for sure. But they go down the west end of Ola and run through the switch. They slid through the switch. And so they sent, we're talking about one of these men that really didn't have any education at all. And they sent him out to flag. And
talking about men?
Yeah. And he went out about a quarter of a mile and put two torpedoes down and came back to the switch and sat down. And old Whitey was ahead, brakeman.
Raymond Hill, when he in that?
He may have been, I don't
think
know.
He was.
But anyhow, here come that freight train. And of course, he hit those two torpedoes. He wasn't near going to get stopped by the time he got up. And this brakeman, White, what was he, Lester White? Was that his name? I don't even remember. We called him Whitey.
Yeah.
He stood there and held, of course, the switch was gapped, obviously. He stood there and held that switch lined up for the siding when that while that train went by him. Raymond was involved.
Yeah, Raymond
was. I'd have been running for the bushes if it had been me. I wouldn't have had a nerve.
And nothing got on the ground?
No.
No. Of course, we had a big investigation, and he got disciplined just like the rest of them. I went to the superintendent. I said, what in the world are you doing disciplining that man? He risked his life trying to help. He said, well, I don't have a choice, Harold. I said, otherwise, I'd do something. That was Leroy.
Yeah.
We had a sister superintendent, Leroy Williams. And Leroy, I like Leroy. The only thing Leroy wanted you to do was your job.
He was a Little Rock guy, wasn't he?
No, well, originally he came out of El Reno. Yeah. And he came down here. Buddy was talking about these old alcoves. They got to where they wouldn't hardly run, you know. But they sent Leroy down here originally as a roundhouse foreman. And he fixed them. These other roundhouse foremen, the dispatcher would call and say, I've got to have this engine so-and-so. And Leroy would say, when I get it ready, I'll let you know when you can have this engine. And he got them in good running order. And he left, then he came back as assistant superintendent. But he was hard in a way, but at the same time, I liked the man. And if, like I said, if you did your job, you wouldn't hear a word out of it.
Yeah.
But if you screwed up, you'd hear from him right quick.
Well, he was just like old man Rich. I mean, you knew he was railroad, Rock Island, and he wouldn't put up with no foolishness. And you knew that.
So. I have to tell you, Buddy and I both had nicknames. I was run by, and he was run scared. But me and Charlie Norman were coming down one day, and he took over at Homewood, you know, and they called on the radio and told us to stop up here at the depot. We wanted to talk to the engineer about something. I don't remember what it was. So I told Charlie, I said, now, you go down here, Perry. I said, you stop in front of the depot, right in front of the depot, because I don't want to have to walk to get back to the depot. And damn if he didn't go down there and run all the way down to the highway crossings.
Oh,
I said, what in the God? I told you to stop in front of the depot. I said, he said, well, you wouldn't have got stopped in front of the depot. I said, well, you want to be a lousy hauler like I am?
Talking about stopping, that's when they start putting these red flags up in old suit. Let's see. C.O. Brakeville was coming to Danville, and he had the red flag stop order out there, and we had to stop for that. And he run by it, I don't know, three or four or five lengths, and he said, buddy, I said, go get that stop board and move it up here.
I remember the first time I went into Memphis, or into Broward. It was this side, on the west side of the river from Memphis, and where the MOP and the Rock Island came together, and then they both went over the same bridge into Memphis. And we went in there, and George Mays, the engineer, but I was running the engine, and the brakeman always had to drop off and make a cut, and I forget exactly what the procedure was. But anyhow, we got up there, and I bunched the train up and looked up there and the signal was red, and I set the brakes and it kept going and kept going. Finally, just, there went that red signal by. And I was about to have, you know, and it couldn't back up. The trainman done got cut off and cut the air out. Old George said, don't worry about it. And he went in, I guess Haley was his trainmaster over, and he gave Haley some song and dance. I don't know what it was.